When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So many of the bargains that we're seeing globally are in the European region. If we were to rank regions of the globe where we're finding the most opportunity, Europe is at the top of the list.
Where and what she is buying for her gold-rated Causeway funds is on Consuelo Mack Wealth Track.
Funding provided by Clearbridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Baird, Bill Miller, Research Affiliates, Strategus Asset Management, Women Investing in Security and Education, and Matthews Asia.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. Value investors of the old Graham and Dodd school were known for buying cheap, unwanted, so-called cigar butt stocks, meaning good for a quick profit to be sold when they rose in price. Well, in his latest annual letter to shareholders, Warren Buffett, a Ben Graham acolyte, explained how his value investing approach changed thanks to his longtime business partner, Charlie Munger. In his tribute to Munger, who died in November of 2023, Buffett writes, "He told me correctly that I had made a dumb decision in buying control of Berkshire, but he assured me, since I had already made the move, he would tell me how to correct my mistake." Charlie, in 1965, promptly advised me, "Warren, forget about ever buying another company like Berkshire, but now that you control Berkshire, add to it wonderful businesses purchased at fair prices and give up buying fair businesses at wonderful prices. In other words, abandon everything you learned from your hero, Ben Graham. It works only when practiced at a small scale." Buffett continued, "With much backsliding, I subsequently followed his instructions." Well, Berkshire is certainly not operating on a small scale. With a stock market capitalization of $900 billion, it fits easily among the world's 10 most valuable companies, and it is sitting on a record $168 billion in cash. This week's guest is a highly respected value manager known for her global and international investing, who is operating on a much smaller and more nimble scale, along with just about everyone else in investment management. She is Sarah Ketterer, Chief Executive Officer of Causeway Capital Management, which she co-founded in 2001 and now has about $45 billion in assets under management. She is portfolio manager for the firm's fundamental strategies, including three of Causeway's five mutual funds. Among them is the flagship Causeway International Value Fund. Launched in 2001, the gold-rated fund was singled out as one of the best international stock funds for 2024 by Morningstar. Ketterer and her team were also named Morningstar's International Stock Fund Manager of the Year in 2017, having been nominated for the same honor in 2013. Ketterer is also a member of Barron's 100 Most Influential Women in U.S. Finance. I asked Ketterer for her views on value investing. Fair companies at wonderful prices or wonderful companies at fair prices?
Consuelo, if there was a maxim that a single one that could guide investing, especially value investing, I'd yearn for it. But there isn't. Sometimes a cigar butt is just exactly what you need. A company that is trading at such a low valuation that ideally, everything has gone wrong that can go wrong has gone wrong, and we see those. And especially if the company's on the upswing to the degree they can generate cash and repurchase shares, that starts to guarantee a return. So we can forgive maybe imperfect management or the business isn't well positioned in its industry. If it's blindingly cheap, that's worthwhile. But you might blend that, as we would in a portfolio, with companies that are just better placed. They may have one or two competitors. They're in an oligopoly. And we're willing to pay a little more for that because we can be very confident that business is going to continue to have pricing power and deliver earnings and cash flow.
What is the value investing landscape now? You run global funds, you run international, the International Value Fund, your flagship fund. What are the opportunities out there now? Are they, you know, is it easier, more difficult, challenging?
The sea change that has occurred, Consuelo, is the return to positive real interest rates in most regions around the world. And this happened in 2022, in March, in the case of the U.S. And with the rising rates and anticipation of rates staying at these levels until inflation, according to central bank measurements, have reached sustained lower levels, this is fantastic for those of us who use valuation tools, because all a stock is in its share price should encapsulate, it's the present value of all the cash it can generate into the future, discounted to present. And now, and this has been true for 18 months, cash is very meaningful. So we're thriving, especially outside the U.S. market, where value has been amply rewarded. 2023, for example, was a year for value outside the U.S.
How much more difficult is it as an investor to compete against the returns that are available on cash and in fixed income?
Cash is delivering a return still less than stock markets around the world. And with active stock selection, we think we can beat that handily. And we should, because investing in equities is definitely riskier than owning cash, no doubt about it. The equity risk premium, the additional return you as investor should receive for taking that risk, should be at least 3 or 4 percentage points more than, say, 10-year bond yields. So we need to deliver 7, 8, 9% returns per annum in order to satisfy investors and compensate them for risk.
And how difficult is that, Sarah, to deliver those kinds of returns at this point? I mean, as you just said, you know, the markets have done extremely well in 2023.
It's not difficult. And one of the reasons why is because, back to your original question about whether or not to look for a cigar butt or a better business trading at a higher valuation, what we've had to do as value investors, especially during what we term value winter, that really brutal period from 2019 to the end of 2021, when growth investing trampled value globally, and investors, because interest rates were so low, zero in the U.S. starting in 2020 and negative overseas in Europe and Japan, we couldn't compete with the growth stocks because nobody cared about valuation. And now it's quite different. And yet what we did in order to survive and thrive for our clients and fund shareholders was to find companies that were creating value in their own business. We call that operational restructuring. And all it means is that a company's management runs the business more efficiently, perhaps sells or offloads, maybe through a spin-off, a poorly performing subsidiary or division, and creates a lot more value for shareholders. And that way, the business starts to generate much more earnings and cash flow and becomes exactly what we wanted it to be, which is a great performer, but we paid a modest price for it.
And given, again, the appreciation in the markets, you know, globally, certainly in Europe and certainly in the U.S., it's still easy to find good values?
Yes. If you sector adjust the European markets, just take Europe, because it's been where investors have fled. I mean, the barren wasteland of global investing has been China over the last 2 years, particularly the last 12 months. But the second prize goes to Europe at record net investment outflows, portfolio flows from markets. But underneath that is, if you sector adjust, take European markets and sector weight them exactly the same way as the U.S., and you find that they're trading at a price earnings multiple that is about the same as they were in 2011 versus the U.S. And that's when Europe was having great difficulty. If you remember, the Eurozone was under pressure and there was some concern about it splitting apart. And we don't think, other than a slower economy, which is a cycle, and regions come out of these cycles, usually with the help of some fiscal and monetary aid, that Europe should be trading at those low levels. So many of the bargains that we're seeing globally are in the European region, whereas Japan has had a huge run, in part catalyzed by the defection from the Chinese market. So that's, if we were to rank regions of the globe where we're finding the most opportunity, Europe is at the top of the list.
Give us an example, if you're looking at sector specific of a U.S. company versus a European company and what the difference in valuations are and opportunities?
Well, let's take the area of rails. So original equipment manufacturer, OEM in rails, the second largest, is a France-listed company called Alstom. And they're huge in rolling stock and signaling and services. They're a phenomenal business because they are, in fact, practically a monopoly. You just can't get this anywhere. And yet, they bungled contracts. They had fixed-price contracts, and the inflation ended up harming them. They made an acquisition with a Bombardier's rail biz, and they mismanaged it and couldn't integrate it properly. All of this is changing. This is what we, again, finding these companies that are in the midst of operational restructuring where they can take what has been an under-earning business and then make it much stronger. That, to us, I mean, if it's a $5 billion market cap company, it could be a $10 billion market cap company within the next 5 years.
One of the interesting things as well is your number one holding is Rolls-Royce. And again, you know, when Morningstar basically praises Causeway funds for your track record and also your discipline in frequently looking at companies that are running into temporary challenges that you think are fixable. So Rolls-Royce, which is your number one holding in the International Value Fund, is another example, right?
It is. But we have had to be very patient, so of our fund shareholders and our institutional clients, because we bought, this is, Rolls-Royce is not, they don't make luxury autos. This is a different Rolls-Royce. This is Rolls-Royce PLC, and they are a world leader in aerospace, specifically wide-body aircraft engines are their largest, and we believe soon to be their most profitable area. And this stock has gone up tenfold from its lows in 2020 when, as you know, we were in a pandemic and there was no flying. That means there were no flying hours, which meant there was no cash flow. So the companies had to go through massive amounts of operational restructuring, of cutting cost. But they, beyond operational restructuring, they've had to recapitalize their balance sheet. They did a rights issue. And then the most brilliant thing they did with their very able chair is to hire an excellent CEO, Tufan Erginbilgic. We call him colloquially Turbo Tufan. But you get a great operator into an oligopolistic business and start to implement more pricing power. And this becomes the magic of recovery of earnings and cash flow. And then as the icing on the cake is when that cash flow starts to get returned to us and our clients in the form of dividends and buybacks, which are meaningful in an environment where real rates are positive.
And Sarah, how early do you get involved in a situation like that where they really got some serious problems?
Well, in the case of Alstom, we got involved after it became clear that they were having difficulty with their Bombardier acquisition integration. In the case of Rolls-Royce, we bought them after they'd had difficulties with a line of new engines, and then the pandemic hit. So we got caught wrong-footed, and then it was up to our effort to decide if this business was going to make it and what it was going to take. And they needed to recapitalize the balance sheet. They needed to lower debt, raise equity. And then we were convinced they had all the raw materials to succeed again. So that's the way to get out of a scrape like that. I mean, you're holding the wrong stock at the wrong time. And if you believe in the business, as we did and still do, is you buy more. And we were very aggressive buying at those low levels. That stock is up over the last 12 months, 150%. And it has been a fantastic stock for clients.
Are there other companies that, I mean, looking at your portfolio that are in the throes of challenges and problems that are early on in their recovery that you'd be willing to talk about?
Well, another European stock that is in recovery is Kering, the global luxury goods maker. The stock's listed in France, but they do business all over the world, Asia being their largest region. And part of the reason why Kering sold off is putting a new creative director into their major brand, Gucci. They own
Gucci.
Bottega Veneta and Yves Saint Laurent and so on. They've a long list of very powerful brands. But these luxury goods stocks, this is an area where Europe excels. There is no counterpart in the US market. This is it. Europe is particularly good in this. LVMH would be another tremendous European luxury house. But in this environment where there are concerns and often well-founded about Chinese spending, consumer spending and on luxury as well as everything else, given the decline in real estate prices there, the stock has fallen quite a bit. And we've used this opportunity to add because our experience is that there's a cadre of consumers who perpetually spend on luxury as long as they're excited about brand. And we think Kering has hired the right people to innovate at Gucci and make it do even better.
One of the things that you've told me in past interviews is that when everyone else is looking in one area, you are looking elsewhere, or you're looking in a way to invest in that area that is being ignored or unrecognized. So AI, how are you dealing with this AI phenomenon?
Well, I have to hand it to my colleagues who are covering the IT and communication services area, because this has been really challenging. The AI beneficiaries, particularly in the US market, those stocks have taken off and left everything else in the dust. But an area where we have given our clients exposure in their portfolios and we've added to in our fund has been semiconductors, specifically memory. And the reason why is because those AI chips need a lot of memory. So as AI chips proliferate, so must memory. In fact, companies like SK Hynix in South Korea and their even larger competitor, Samsung Electronics, SK Hynix was the first to high bandwidth memory, which is a type of memory chip that's lower, uses less power, and very effective in concert with AI chips for servers and the huge amount of need we're going to have in the future. And Samsung is hot on their heels, about to be certified by the major AI chip companies to provide high bandwidth memory. And then Micron in the US is behind them. And that's it. Those are the three manufacturers. Again, this idea, it's an oligopoly. There's pricing power. It doesn't mean it's not cyclical. But this cycle, in terms of demand, looks like it's going to be extremely strong because of AI.
Compounding income is one of the hallmarks of your approach as well. So how important are dividends?
They're very important, but they don't need to be present up front. I mean, back to the Rolls-Royce example, we've had to be very patient, but we're seeing this company revolutionize its earnings. It went from bleeding cash, now generating over £1.5 billion a year, and that could double within the next several years, given how well the business is managed. And meanwhile, with Boeing having problems with their 737 MAXs, some of the aircraft that would be in the skies aren't, and that's leading to older aircraft being flown and more flying hours for companies like Rolls, which means more cash. And as long as we know it's coming, we're convinced that we can incorporate that into our valuation, because again, really all a stock is the present value of all the cash it can generate into the future.
I'm looking at some of your holdings in the Global Value Fund and obviously some of the U.S.-based companies. So Disney is one, and Alphabet is another. Citigroup is one of your Global Value Fund holdings. What do they have in common, those three companies? Very disparate industries.
Yeah, well, they are very disparate. But right. I think we just think the market has underestimated all three of them. I mean, Disney in particular, as the business still not yet making money in streaming, but working assiduously toward that. And the brand portfolio there is fantastically valuable. So from a value investor perspective, thinking about that business as some of the parts, you know, isolating their streaming from their theme park business, from the rest of the company, we thought it was a bargain, and it still remains one given the amount of restructuring that can and will go on there. And part of what had to happen was a change in management. We see that all the time. Citi's had a change in management. They both have reasonably new CEOs. Disney's is new again. And
Bob Iger, right? Exactly. It's been around a long time.
New again? It's yeah. New. but who knows that business better? There are some stocks in the U.S., they're a lot of work. Let's just put it this way. In order to be committed to operational restructuring, we as investors need to be on this company in ways that are just exhausting. And that's why we get paid. That's why we're active managers. I can't underestimate the word active. Our job is to understand what the position the business is in now. How, given, for example, in the Disney case, how Netflix created such attractive operating profit margins in their streaming business, and how much of that Disney could possibly achieve. And with conservative assumptions and lots of interaction with company management, with investor relations, the back and forth that helps us get a better picture of the business, then we take a position and estimate those earnings and the cash flow into the future. And what makes our estimate different from others is that we're very conservative. We in the case of Citi, for example, where we're assuming rates kind of taper back down in the U.S. maybe more aggressively than what you see in rate futures, and only because we need that business to do well even if they don't have the ability to sustain wider net interest margins. Like, that's the whole crux of value investing, is that you're not really paying for much in the future. You've decided that all the goodies aren't going to happen, but if they do, even better, because then you get those additional returns.
So you mentioned how active you have to be as an active investor. Are you an activist investor as well?
I think the closest we've gotten to activist, perhaps Rolls-Royce again would be an example, where we agitated for change because it needed to happen urgently for the company to thrive. And my colleague Jonathan Eng, who is the portfolio manager covering industrials, was quoted in the Financial Times. That's pretty loud for us. Normally we're very quiet behind the scenes, being very clear with management. We have a European stock now, a company in household products and nutrition called Reckitt Benckiser. They make Lysol and Dettol and Durex. They have a whole array, Woolite, of brands you would have heard of, not to mention Mucinex, over-the-counter type drugs. But their business has not been well managed, and we're spending quite a bit of time with CEO, CFO, particularly the new CFO comes from Procter & Gamble, to give that company some idea of what we expect as investors. So that it's active. Maybe not activists, we're not holding them for ransom, but we're being very clear what we want, which is them to accelerate. We think they can do revenue growth, so maybe 3% or 4% per year, and a share buyback yield of maybe 4%. So they deliver to shareholders. There might be a 3% dividend yield with that too, but it's just not quite enough in this demanding environment where consumer staples companies have to really show that they can grow the top line, and that comes from innovation, making very astute acquisitions. But for that, we're only paying 13 times next year's earnings, so there's a lot of room for this business, if better managed, to deliver huge for shareholders.
Sarah, one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio. What do you think we should all own some of in a long-term diversified portfolio?
I really wanted to say Rolls-Royce because I love the fact that we'll be flying. I don't know what's going to replace the aircraft, and we need engines, and they are in such a good position. But there's another that we very much like, Canadian Pacific Kansas City Southern. It's in end of 2001, Canadian Pacific bought Kansas City Southern, and that connected Canada with Mexico, running right through the United States. And that sort of nonstop trip is valuable. And as of last April, they have a new CEO, Keith Creels, we think the best in the industry. So to see pricing power, this is a higher valuation stock than we typically buy up front, but we're convinced the company will grow into their valuation, and those multiples will be low because of the type of operation restructuring that's happening. Just much more efficiency in how that new rail system worked, and Kansas City Southern was underpricing their routes. But we're hearing anecdotally from companies what they're willing to pay. They'll pay more to ship their goods from Mexico, which is the beneficiary of a lot of nearshoring, and it will continue to be, to the little bit as a hedge against China, more manufacturing in Mexico to be brought into the U.S., and rail is by far the most efficient way to do it.
Sarah Ketterer, so great to have you on Wealth Track once again, and I'm delighted to hear that there are real value opportunities all over the world that you are finding at Causeway. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Consuelo.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point is be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy only when others are fearful. Well, that, of course, is the classic quote from Warren Buffett's 1986 annual shareholder letter describing Berkshire's approach to the occasional outbreaks of those two super contagious diseases, fear and greed. Buffett has taken his own advice over the years. A recent example is he took advantage of investors' fear of Japanese stocks. Berkshire started building stakes in five Japanese trading companies in 2019 when the Nikkei was trading around 40% below its record 1989 close. It has since surpassed it. In his latest annual report, he announced approximately 9% stakes in each, and the unrealized gain from the five was $8 billion at year-end 2023. Sarah Ketterer just talked about how cheap the Chinese stock market is. Fear is rampant there. The late, great Peter Bernstein, author of Against the Gods, The Remarkable Story of Risk, once told us, "You are not truly diversified until you own something you are really uncomfortable with." By that standard, how diversified is your portfolio? Next week, why influential strategist Ed Yardeni says AI isn't intelligent. That's in part two of our interview with Ed Yardeni. In this week's extra feature, why Sarah Ketterer is keeping Causeway's Shanghai office open while so many businesses are shutting theirs. Please follow us on Facebook, X, and our YouTube channel. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Enjoy your weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.